My name is Clancy Emmisland, and I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here. Marsha, you could have gone on a little bit longer, couldn't you? I don't care for myself, but it's a great pleasure to be here. I've really enjoyed this weekend. I want to thank Bob for inviting me. People wonder why Bob invites me all every year. If you knew as much as I do about Bob, you'd understand. I could get him Lee's old cell tomorrow morning if I wanted to. And that's just for abusing Ruth. But I'll tell you, this has been a great weekend. To those of you who came in late this afternoon, some of you did, I know, and some who came in this morning, I must truthfully say, I've been sober long. Oh, I should give my sobriety date. I guess they do that. My sobriety date is October 31st, 1958. For that, I'm very grateful. But let me make a little more trouble. For those of you standing in the back, you'll be glad to know that there's several seats down here being saved for people who didn't show up. That may cheer you up a little bit. If they ever drop by, are there seats being saved for somebody? Come on down. There's 3, 4. Come on. Young, healthy guys first. One over there. I didn't really mean to come here and be an usher. You have a little something in the loge here, miss? There's another seat down here between two girls. No, you guys were already sitting. Stay down. Anyway. But I've been to a lot of conventions. I go to a lot of conventions. I hear a lot of speakers because in California, where I live, most of the meetings are speaker meetings, unlike most of the only place in the country that I know it's that way. Discussion meetings are rare and few and far between. I guess maybe that's why there's a lot of sober AAs in Southern California. One of the reasons it really is, I suppose. But most of the meetings I've gone to in my life are speaker meetings. So I've gone to thousands of speaker meetings. Over 10,000 speaker meetings, I suppose, all told. And so I've heard speakers. I know all the speakers. I've heard all the speakers over the country. This is the first weekend that I can recall in many years that I've been to a convention where I have never heard any of the speakers before. And this was great. And that doesn't mean anything in itself, because that you can go to the nut house and hear speakers you never heard before. But I don't recall for a long time, I can't remember the last time, when I've been to a convention where every speaker was absolutely excellent. I thought it was just great. It was just great. Those of you who missed any of the meetings, Gene last night gave a wonderful talk. He got a little hung up on his voyeurism. That's why I got bifocals. What do you know, all alcoholics says in our book in page 69, appropriately enough. It talks about sex hang-ups. And says some people need more pepper than others. That's all. It's no big deal. I know that when I was kind of new, a couple years sober, streaking had just started. And I was at the Santa Monica Beach one day, and to the best of my knowledge, I became the first streaker on the Santa Monica Beach. And I was arrested for indecent exposure, which was bad enough, but later it was even worse. They dropped the charges on the grounds of insufficient evidence. Well, but Gene gave a fine talk. Lee gave an excellent talk this morning. This seemed to be a nice-looking young man. Turned out to be some kind of a hideous convict. And They wanted me to sit next to them at the second meeting. I said, no dice, you know. And he'd been in jail every time he drank. He went to the prison and jail. I hope you won't take offense at this, Lee, but because I've been around AA quite a while, and let me give you some unsolicited advice. As far as I can see, a person like you really shouldn't drink. You just don't handle it at all. I want you to know that. And Pat this morning gave such a fine talk. Where'd she go? I guess she's not even here tonight, huh? I thought maybe you'd heard what you came to hear and went home again. But Pat gave an excellent talk, and she looked so lovely and charming, it's hard to believe that, as she said, she was one of the ladies at the end of the bar that guys like me would have a few drinks and find progressively more attractive. Because I was sober, I could never dare ask a girl for anything, it seemed like. But when I had a few drinks, they became lovely. I don't know, I'm sure it's happened to a lot of guys in this room. Find yourself at the end of the evening. Go up and imply that there will be delights beyond her comprehension if she'll like to join me in the old Chevy. Now, if this old broad would say, no! God, if I were sober, I believe I'd actually cut my wrists. I couldn't stand the humiliation or hang myself. But when you're drinking, you don't. It isn't that way. Don't feel rejected. I feel sorry for her. Too bad, bitch. Don't come begging tomorrow. That's why I drink. And Ernie this afternoon got back to a theme of Lee's had this morning about blue-eyed and blonde guy, and a lot of talk about that this weekend, blonde and blue-eyed. I grew up in a Norwegian Lutheran community up in northern Wisconsin, and everybody was blonde and blue-eyed. And the few black-haired people, although they had to be Catholics, we found them exciting and mysterious. And it was really exciting to be around black-haired, swarthy people, and blue-eyed, blonde people were just goofs. And your speaker tomorrow morning, Ed L. from New Jersey, I have never heard him speak. I'm looking forward to hearing him speak, but I've talked to him. He's a nice guy, and I have spies who have heard him speak. And they said that we will enjoy that very much. I trust that we will all gather in this room tomorrow. You can put off your hurry to get home to count the flowers in the wallpaper for a couple hours. But this has been a grand convention. Bob, you've done a good job, and I very much appreciate to be part of it. I've had a kind of a strange couple of weeks. Last Saturday, through some lucky break, I was home in Los Angeles. One of the few stories I'm home. And so I'm an old fool. I know that I'm an old fool, but emotionally I'm not old. Emotionally I'm not very mature, I'm afraid. But last Saturday morning, here I am. I pitched a doubleheader softball game. We had a big softball thing that I pitched two games and won one, and my outfield left me down on the other one. They just weren't fast going. They couldn't go back fast enough. And then at noon I served lunch to 150 people every Saturday. 150 each come to my backyard. They were there today and had a great time, they tell me. And then in the afternoon we played volleyball till just about dropped, and I took a shower and went to a guy who sponsors his 20th birthday party, and then I went spoke at our group Saturday night. And then conducted a 15-year birthday party afterwards for a guy who sponsored. And I went to sleep that night, and I really had to read a while to get down. I just felt wonderful. And I felt young and dynamic, just a wonderful day. And I was thinking about that 2 weeks ago tonight. 2 weeks ago, I was talking at a meeting in El Paso. And that afternoon, I had a kind of a an experience that I perhaps it's a bit too bit too self-induced emotionalism, but I'm kind of a romantic in the romantic sense. And I found myself standing in a neighborhood in front of a garage that exactly 40 years before I had killed myself in that city, in that town. And I looked at that garage and was trying to think what I was. As sober that day as I was the day I stood and watched. I was sober and had been sober for some time. What kind of desperation, what kind of absolute desperation would induce me to think about killing myself dramatically? Now don't misunderstand me. I think it's safe to say that most every drunk at one time or another has either tried or thought about trying suicide. Because that just seems to be one of the things you do. And most drunks have think about suicide from time to time. I think most of them do. And most of them, sometimes they write long notes. But drunken suicides is the funny thing. Drunken suicides are rarely successful. And the reason is because usually, it turns out, it seems like, the guy or girl is committing suicide to punish someone, to make them sorry. And they realize, as they start to go under perhaps, I'm not going to be here to watch them be sorry. And drunken suicides always seem to, for some reason or another, never quite work. I've gotten a call once or twice in my life where I've had a guy say, Clancy, I know you wanted to help me, but I've decided to kill myself. I've taken an overdose of pills. I don't want anyone to come to 1421 3rd Street. And this kind of thing. You know when most successful suicides take place? Within a month after being sober. Sober alcoholics commit suicide. Sober drunkards successfully commit suicide. And most of these successful suicides have no notes. It isn't a matter of anybody being sorry. It is just, as our book calls it, that period of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization where you just want to get out. And I think about that. I was looking at that garage and thinking, I didn't leave any note because I really was literally unable to continue. And the reason I had to imagine what the emotions were because I don't remember it. I don't remember it at all because sometime later, as a result of that, well, I'll tell you why. My wife and children went to church on a Saturday afternoon, and I couldn't stand it anymore. I had determined to stay sober. And I had promised my son that I'd stay sober. And I'd promised him because I was in jail when he died. And I thought this will never happen. Just overnight, but it was the wrong night. This will never happen to my children again. So I pulled the car in the garage, shut the door, and hooked up a hose, went to sleep and died. And a neighbor watching this, and I don't know, or I don't know if he watched it or just happened to see it or whatever it might be, but one in a million walked over to see what the hell's going on and found me dead in the car. And they pulled me out and beat on my chest and they breathed in my mouth and rushed me to the county hospital. They worked on me and oxygenated me and talked to me and determined I was severely emotionally disturbed and moved me to a high security locked ward where they gave me some tests and determined that I had severe mental illness. And diagnosed me as a schizophrenic with paranoid tendencies and committed me for an indefinite period up to the rest of my life to the Texas State Insane Asylum in Big Spring, Texas. And there's nothing in my commitment papers about alcohol because I'd been sober for some time. And I was there about 2 weeks, and as many times happens to all of us, you get the heat off for a little while, even in a locked situation. At least you're secure. You know the rules here. And I escaped. And I thought, what are they doing, man? I've been some kind of a success. These $60, $70 a month redneck pukes have to treat me like this. So they said, "You don't try to escape out of here, boy. It's escape-proof hospital." Yeah. So about 2 weeks, I found a way to get through a door and down a corridor and through another door and across the yard and over a fence. And the fox was loose in West Texas. And as I got over that fence and started going, I suddenly realized what they said is true. That's an escape-proof mental hospital. But you don't know till you get out, which seems incongruous. But you suddenly realize they can see you running for 3 days. Just, and you feel like such a fool in your white bathrobe out there. Just, and it's just a matter of time before somebody field glasses pick up. Well, there goes that little Yankee sumbitch now. And they snatched me back and determined that I was emotionally disturbed as the result of this run. So they gave me a series of electric shock treatments 3 times a week. Bang, 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 bang. For some weeks, until they really knocked me out. That's why to this day I don't remember committing suicide or what led up to it. Because once you've had enough shock treatments, your memory when you first got it is all gone, but it comes back in pieces, but you never quite get the last part of it. And my first conscious memory of all of this is little by little, I'm coming to little by little over a period of days, and somewhere that I'd never seen before. It's some kind of a funny room with bars and screens on the window, and it was full of funny people. They all had bathrobes and a bib where they were drooling. I thought, what the hell is this? I looked down and I had a bib covered with drool. I still don't know where I was. The landscape looked funny. It looked, and I don't know if you've ever seen an electric shock where they give a lot of intense electric shock. But the people really get out of it. And it sounds over dramatic. But what they do is this. A lot of them. You walk like this. Until you come to the wall. And it looks kind of funny, but it isn't really very funny when you see a bunch of people doing that. And go over to the wall. I remember this, the other thing I remember is coming to is looking on the wall. Every day everybody goes over and looks on the wall at the list. Don't know what the list is for, but you just hope your name isn't on it. Because if your name is on it, you get electric shock treatments that day. It's your duty list, as it were. And I got off the electric shock treatments finally, but they had zonked me out badly. I didn't know where I was or my name. And then a thing that confirmed it to me was that, I don't know how I got off on this, but in the 1950s, early, mid-1950s, mental health was not a big priority item. And they had old red brick buildings and old red mental hospitals and low-quality people, not many. So what they would do when they gave shock treatments, they would have any reliable patient on the ward take part. So they might have you come in and hold a leg, and somebody else hold a leg. I don't know if you've ever seen an electric shock treatment. You maybe haven't. But it's like you're electrocuted. You watch the body go, like that. And you have to hold them down because they'll... And every time that happened, I did that several times, every time that happened, somehow that was my body there, and they were doing this to me. And I tell you, I don't believe I've ever been so terrified. And I had no pain, no nothing, just terrified. I remember thinking later, months later, after I looked back on that with some degree of sense, that I now begin to understand how you can brainwash prisoners, like in Korea or wherever it might be. Because if someone would have said to me, give me the plans to the atomic bomb or you're going to get electric shock treatment. Really would. And the another thing that seems kind of funny now, but it really wasn't funny, whenever they gave electric shock treatments, they'd played organ music over PA system to hold down the cries and so on. And they always played the same song. I've never talked about this, I don't think, before. But the song was da 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 da. They played this organ music. And when you heard that, you know that pretty soon the lights are going to dim. Bzzz. 2 years later, I could be walking down the street in Dallas, and I'd hear organ music came out of a storefront, and I'd break into a sweat without even being aware of it. Just a conditioned reflex, just terrified, and it's just terrible. And I had no idea. Last thing I remembered vaguely was working in San Francisco, and here I was in some place called Texas. That's all I. They said, "Yeah, you came here. You got a family, and really." And little by little, my memory came back. And they transferred me finally to a ward of senile old men, where they were senile and I was not thinking right. So it was just very quiet, very low-key. And it was a bad situation. And I had to stay there until I got well. And it got apparent after a while, as my memory got back a little bit, I never was going to get well, at least technically, because you were at the beck and call of these $60 or $70 a month attendants. The doctor just came shooting through, and they would read the report. And if you did something that said something that offended one of these guys, you'd say, patient was restless. And you were gone. Just like if you get two or three of those, you were back in shock treatments. There's no hearing, there's no nothing. Hey, boy, you're going back over to Ward 5. And it was scary. I'd start to do good, and I'd do or say something that offended somebody, and pretty soon I'd be right in the cusp again. All was so very, very frightening. It looked like I was never going to get out of there. But then Christmas came, and about 2 weeks before Christmas, they looked at my record and saw that I had directed a grand opera at the University of Texas that spring. And so they said, well, give the old Yankee something to do. So they let me direct the Christmas pageant in the mental hospital that year. And I didn't really know what was going on, but I did the best I could. It wasn't a very complex production. The director's main job was trying to keep the three wise men off the Virgin Mary, if you had any way to do that. You know. And the next year came, and there I was. And I started a little hospital newspaper. I tried to do little things. And the thing that saved my life, the thing that enables me to be here tonight, is that winter, of all the winters in the year, in the world, and all the places in the world, that winter, a man named Les Ross, who was an AA member in Big Spring, Texas, felt that Texas really needed some kind of facility where they could send drunkards and alcoholics. And he'd been badgering the state to let him give him a little piece of the ward at Big Spring so he could treat alcoholics. And he finally said, okay, we're not going to get paid. You can have half of Ward 9, but that's it. He said, okay. And he went in there, and he made an arrangement with the state so the state would commit men for 30 days. Their family could commit them for 30 days. They'd come in, and he'd talk to them about Alcoholics Anonymous and send them back out. And this set up, and by this time I'd risen to plant the mailman. I was going to get the mail every day and get passed out the mail to the various wards. And I saw this alcoholic ward there in Les Ross, and I heard about it, and it started to trigger thoughts in my mind, because as my memory came back little by little, I remember being an AA. And I'd been an AA for 6-7 years by that time, in and out, in and out, in and out. And I knew that AA didn't help people like me. But I knew how to talk the game. And I began to work a plan so I could get Mr. Les Ross, see if I could get into that ward, maybe, because I could get out that way. I could never get out based on my behavior. And one day I nailed Mr. Ross in the hall. I was in pretty good shape. I said, Mr. Ross, I'd like to talk to you a minute. Yes, boy, what is it? I said, you know, Mr. Ross, I'm in here on a suicide commitment from El Paso. And you know, it sounds terrible, but it's all due to that damn drink. I seem to live so comfortably. Then I have some sort of a craving for alcohol that I can't handle, almost an obsession. And I drink and drink once more alcohol, and I drink beyond what I should do. And I understand you have some way to help this problem. Do you have any kind of a book I could read, or do you have any kind of meetings I could go to, or is there any literature that I could just find the God I lost in the bottle? And Mr. Ross's eyes went He had never seen a sincere newcomer before at that hospital. Why, boy, that's wonderful. You just let me know. You're Ward 8 there. I'll get back to you, boy. And he went away, and I didn't hear from him. I thought, that old bastard has burned me again. He's just another one of these boobs. But he came back about 4 days later and said, boy, you can go to the meetings in our ward starting tomorrow. I didn't want to say, where you been? I needed you. But I found out later he had to go through the state capitol in Austin because it was absolutely against the law for psychiatric patients to go into the alcoholic ward. Just an entirely different thing. So I got into the alcoholic ward to the meetings. And Mr. Ross would just tell us about AA. And these guys, really, most of them came in there. They didn't want to hear it. They were there for 30 days. They were going to get out no matter what happens. You know, you'd sit next to a guy and say, what are you going to do to get out of here, Ben? I'm going to kill that bitch. Yeah. And Mr. Ross would give us lectures, and nobody wanted to hear him. Nobody wanted to hear him. Say, well, boys, today we're going to talk about the 12 steps. I'm going to give you an hour on the 12 steps and what they mean. I mean, oh, man. But not me. I knew what I had to get him. Oh, good. And he'd get done with the 12 steps after an hour of this almost cruel and unusual punishment. Sir, are there any questions, boys? I have a question, Mr. Ross. Could you tell us more about the fourth step and how we reach down within us and get some of this garbage out and find a little freedom from the guilt that's always hurt us? Yes, I can tell you that, boy. And the rest of the room would say, oh, shit. But I didn't care about them. I had to get him. And pretty soon I got him. People came and went. I got to be secretary of the group. But I wasn't burdened by any sincerity, so I really did as good a job as I could. And they used to finally send me out, take me out to take attendance, take me out to little towns around there. Big Spring, Odessa, Midland, San Angelo. And I'd go talk at the town AA groups that with my attendance. Well, our speaker tonight is one of the boys from the state hospital, Clancy. I'd give him inspiring little talks such as, friends, I want to thank each and every one of you for bringing a message to I and my fellow members of the Alcoholics Anonymous group in the Big Spring State Hospital. It's as though we were going across a vast desert of alcoholism, and we had come to the tall green hills of sobriety, but they were too steep for our weary legs. But wonderful men and women such as you pointed out, they said, over here, there are 12 golden stairs that you can climb one after another. And as we climb these golden stairs, we are looking forward to returning to our homes throughout West Texas and carrying this message to others, lost wayfarers, to be able to say, over here, over here. I know it must get wearisome and tiresome for you to come to the hospital and tell us these stories. But if you knew what wonderful work you did, may God bless you in your continued good work. Thank you. Now, you can laugh. That got me out of the Texas Nut House. And I never had another drink till I ran out of Thorazine. But I had a difficult time after I went back to El Paso, and people were nervous about nuts, and I was a nut. But finally somebody gave me a job, and somebody else gave me a job. I was taking Thorazine a lot every day, and I went to an AA meeting once a week because that was part of my conditions of my release, and I went there, and I just hated it, but I had to do it until I was a year sober. I remember the night of September 22nd, 1957 or 6 or 7, standing in Juarez, watching for the 1 year to expire from my suicide. And like somebody else mentioned, I didn't get drunk. I had one drink. And that was great. I went home, and the next night I went to my weekly AA meeting to get my token for my year. And I stopped and had a few drinks with dinner. I went there. An old guy named Tobra, so he's dead now, but we were talking about him 2 weeks ago. Well, we have a token tonight for Clancy. He said, he says, I don't know if I should give you this, boy. Have you been drinking? I says, I was sober a year. Give me the goddamn token. And by that time, my Thorazine had made me industrious enough. I got a job in Dallas, and a couple months later I went to Dallas, had one of the best jobs of my career, working for Tracy Locke, working on the old LCL Marads for the board and company. My wife, children came in, and eventually I began to drink more heavily, and pretty soon in Dallas, I lost my job at Tracy Locke, because I came in, which was a very swank agency, and I was a talented guy, but I came in covered with vomit and sick and smelling like sweat, and this offended them. And I felt bad about it, and I got a job in a big firm called Southwestern Gaming. They made me a job as production manager, overseeing all their production, because I knew quite a bit about that stuff. And while I was there, somebody came in and repoed my car. That's an embarrassing thing when you're... Okay. Where from? General Motors Acceptance. Give me the keys to the goddamn car. I guess they're going to take it and fix it. So then I had to stay late every night. I remember, I didn't get off of that. I don't remember talking about this. Stay late every night because I had to be there after everybody went home so I could steal the company pickup truck to drive to the other side of Dallas to go home and get up early no matter how bad I felt and have that truck parked by the time anybody got there. And it was just hideous. And one night, of course, I stopped to have a couple beers, more too many, and I wound up, came out of a bar at 2 in the morning and couldn't find the truck. And you can't report a stolen truck when you've stolen it previously. And I milled around, and it's just, I remember up and down the streets half all night. I just, what am I going to do? It turned out what had happened. I found out later, the owner and his wife had been coming home from the show and saw their truck there. And said, well, somebody stole our truck. So she drove the car home, he took the truck, and away they went and left me looking for it all night. And so I was fired, and they went out to my... It caught a hold of my wife and said, well, it's too bad. And she said, yes, it's been this way for a long time. And they said, you ought to get rid of it. And she said, "That's I've been hearing that for 5 years. So eventually I got home a couple of days later. And the wife and children were gone. And I'd run away from home many times, but the first they never left. And my pile of clothes in the living room. And I thought, isn't that just like him? You get a bad break and they turn on you. And I grabbed my clothes. The next thing I knew, I was in El Paso trying to see some old friends. They said, Jesus, what's happened to you? You're terrible. And a week or so after that, I was in the Phoenix drunk tank. And I got in a fight on the street. And some guy turned out to be a plainclothesman, for God's sake. Run a bad luck, I'll tell you. And I was in jail overnight. At that time, the Phoenix drunk tank was on the third floor of the city hall. And there was no air conditioning. And this was August. And you just go up there, just... And it was so hot. And I got sick, and I vomited. And I vomited on somebody's bunk and turned out to be a trustee. And he was cross. And he said, damn you, and he knocked me down and kicked my front teeth out. Fortunately, I'd had a lot of psychoanalysis in the previous years. So I was almost instantly able to identify his problem. I remember thinking, this guy is overreacting. But I got out of that jail, and I'd lost my clothes now, and I was dirty and sweaty and smelled bad, and I was sick, and I had no more money. And what do you do then? You look up Alcoholics Anonymous. That's the only place you can go and pass. Something called Arid Club on North 3rd. So I sauntered over there trying to look like an eccentric millionaire so I wouldn't get vagged, and got in the Arid Club, and it was just terrible. The same old idiots. Welcome, welcome, you know. Finally, some old lady came over. She's a nice old lady. Probably the way Pat would have turned out if she hadn't stopped drinking. She said, well, Sonny, she said, you're a young man. And how are you feeling bad? I said, yes. Feeling pretty bad. She said, well, it's so wonderful that you're getting to AA before you've had to suffer and go all the way. That cost her. I finally convinced her I just needed a couple dollars for the 12th step house so I could get back to the meeting that night. She gave me $10 and I used that, got out of Phoenix and New York minute to Los Angeles. I was trying to get to Seattle because I was, when I was left the nut house, I'd been signed out to my wife. And she had custody over me. She had to send a report in every week as how I was doing. And I assumed that when she left, she probably had turned me in because she was a snitch. And I wanted to get away from Texas. You know, that's really tough around the house when you're sensitive and your wife says, don't you think you're going to get the garbage out? And you have to say, good idea. Glad you thought of that, honey. I got in Los Angeles, and I was wound up in a... I went out to a place called the AA Club, 60-year-old club. Somebody I took a bus out there, so I've got some money and took a bus out there. And I was drunk, and I went in there, and they asked me to leave. And some guy said, why don't you come down to the beach? We got a real good deal going. Went down there, something called the Tender Loving Care Club. There were a bunch of idiots. I was there for 2-3 days. And some guy in AA 2 years had started this new club. He was sick of AA because he thought AA was too wrapped up in God, and he was above that. So he calls it something Tender Loving Care Club. He kind of became God, and finally AA turned out had sent them a letter saying you cannot call yourself an AA group because not all of AA recognizes you personally as God, so whatever you're doing. So he threw all the alcoholics out. I was one of them. I just hadn't been there very long, and I was thrown out. And I said to him, geez, Chuck, what are you going to do now? He says, I'm going to take a narcotics addict. I said, geez, you don't take narcotics. He said, I know, but they haven't got in the office to send me letters. So we took a narcotics addict. We thought he'd be crazy. He'll be crazy and bankrupt. But he changed his name to Synanon, made himself $1 million. It's a funny thing. 20-some years later, when his whole empire came down and said, must corrupt and bad, you know where they found Chuck? Sitting in Phoenix, drunk. Because that's... when it all went down, he went back, he reverted to what he was, an alcoholic, and drank. But then next thing I knew, I was in an all-night theater on Skid Row. And I was sick and desperate. Got up at 5 in the morning, went out in the street. I don't know if you've ever been to all-night theaters. But all-night theaters are not all-night theaters. They run until about 5 o'clock. And then they get you out. There's nothing in the world worse than coming out when it's cold outside and you're gray and you just woke up and you feel sick and you're hungover and desperate. I came out of there. To me, that is the ultimate. I mean, all the bad things that ever happened to me in my early years of sobriety, whenever I felt like drinking, I thought, I don't care if I lose my job. I don't care if I lose anything. But I couldn't bear to come out of that all-night theater one more time and know there isn't one person that I know about here in the world that cares whether I live or die. And so I went over to the blood bank on East 4th Street, tried to sell a pint. We used to call it the dance hall. Because before 6 o'clock, the guys would be standing out in front going like this. Sick and desperate. Finally got in, and they wouldn't take my blood. I didn't have enough iron in my blood. It didn't coagulate, their little test tube. So I walked up to a place on a mission. I went in there and I said, I need some breakfast, maybe a bed. And they said, no, you're at the wrong time. What do you mean I'm at the wrong time? You're supposed to help people, God damn it. And I gave them a bad time. Finally, two guys threw me out and says, don't come back here, you damn bum. As I've said many times, I tried to explain to them, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas at El Paso. Ads that I helped write, the old Elsie Delmer ads were running that very night in Life and Time and Saturday Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair. And when you have no front teeth, you don't hit those consonants quite as cleanly. But I thought about that yesterday morning, because yesterday morning was just like that morning. Cold and a slight drizzle. And I stood outside of that Skid Row mission on 4th and Los Angeles Street in Los Angeles. And I couldn't think of anyone who would accept a collect phone call from me. My mother used to, but she refused, not because she didn't love me, but because she couldn't bear to have my promises broken again and again and again. She would give her life for me, but she couldn't bear to die in the installment plan. And my father was so disappointed in me, because I was his only child, and I'd had started off so well. And I'm sure there were a lot of people who would accept a collect phone call from me, but I couldn't think of any of them. And if a man would have come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to about 100 pounds. You've lost everything. You've used to be something, but you're nothing now. You've lost your family. You've lost your home. You've lost your career. You've lost your clothes. You've lost your front teeth. You've lost everything. And you've been going to AA off and on for over 9 years now. You've been in psychoanalysis for thousands and thousands of dollars worth. And you read philosophy, and your imitation intellectualness is pursued to the nth degree. He said, if he'd have said, why can't you admit you're an alcoholic? My God, it isn't that hard a thing. And if my life depended on it, which it did, I suppose, I would have had to say, but I'm not. You don't understand. It is not the way it looks. And I'd say this magic word that's killed people like us by the millions. My case is different. And if he had said to me, what prove that you're not an alcoholic? I couldn't have done that. I didn't have enough perception. I just had the feeling. I knew I wasn't, but I didn't know why. I knew I wasn't, though. And so I would have had to take refuge behind what frightened sick people like me do when they get frightened and sick. Get the hell out of my face! Screw you! Leave me alone! Get out of here! I'd have had to say. Because I wouldn't know the answer. But I know the answer now. I know why I knew and was willing to bet my life I was not an alcoholic. And I've known it for many years. And I've known it. I've learned it by my own life. I've learned it by working with many, many alcoholics and watching my own symptoms manifest themselves in them and think, oh, that's what that is. That's what that feeling is. I'll tell you something in case you're kind of new. You will learn more by working with others than you ever will by studying yourself. Because between me and them is just air. But between me and me is a labyrinth of rationalizations and justifications and self-pity and victimization. But I know why. And the newest guy in this room understands it, I'm sure. Everybody knows what an alcoholic is. The guy over here, 4 days sober. The guy over here, 6 days sober. All the rest of you. You know what an alcoholic is. Everybody knows that. It's a person, when they drink alcohol, their emotions get all screwed up, their lives get painful, everything goes to hell. Eventually they're driven to some place like AA, and AA straightens them out and gets them sober, and their emotions get comfortable and their lives get straightened out, and they live good lives after that, pretty good lives. And I know that's true. I've never questioned that, because in all the years I was in and out of AA meetings, I didn't go very often after a while, but I'd go once when the heat was really on, I'd be sick and desperate. I remember sneaking out of my office at noon, going to lunch, and instead of going to lunch, going to back of some little AA meeting and sitting in the back where nobody would know me and listen and think, what in the hell do these idiots have that I don't have? What is it I'm missing? And I had to come to the conclusion I'm not like them. But I remember hearing people from time to time, it stuck in my mind. I remember sitting in Dallas at the Town North Club in the back row one day at noon, and hearing some guy say something that I was thinking about it today when Ernie was talking about his son, very touching about his son. But remember sitting there sick and looked at my watch, and this guy said he was so happy because that weekend he said, I'm going to see my two little boys. I haven't seen them for 5 years, but this weekend they're going to be given to me. I'm going to take them to the zoo. It's going to be wonderful. We're going to have a wonderful time. And I feel so close to those boys that I haven't seen them in 5 years. I remember sitting in the back row thinking, Jesus, what is wrong with me? I dropped my kids off at school this morning. And you feel closer to your kids than I do to mine. What kind of deal is that? What's wrong with me? There's something sick about me. I remember sitting in San Francisco, somewhere, I guess, in the Chinatown old Alano Club they had up there on the second floor up on Grand Street. And hearing a woman say something to the effect of, now you men won't understand this, she said, but you women will. I've felt dirty inside and out for so long, and I've bathed myself in every possible way there is to bathe myself, and I still feel dirty inside and out. And yet, since coming here and doing some of the things my sponsor insists I do, I'm starting to feel cleaner than I ever felt. And I think I'm going to be clean enough for anybody one of these days. And I just owe it all to you. And I remember sitting there thinking, you don't have to be a woman to understand that. You know, I feel dirty inside and out. And I have for a long time, and I always have. The knowledge of how far I am from what I want to be and wanted to be when I was a boy. And a guy in Chicago at the Logan Square group up in the second floor. There's no Logan Square group. I guess I used to go to second floor groups a lot. But he's saying, well, I'm a vice president of AT&T, or IBM it was. And he says, for a couple of years, I really thought they were going to find me out. You know, I don't know what the hell they're going to find out, but they're going to find me out. Because I was faking it. I just knew it. And since I came here and got this old... believe I'm not faking it. I'm doing a good job. They're lucky to have me. And I'm glad, but it's all because of this program. I think, man, I envy you. Because every day I go to work, I know they're going to find me out. I don't know what they're going to find out, but they're going to find me out. And on and on. That's what an alcoholic is. I knew I wasn't like that. And it wasn't because of my drinking. I drank. I drank as much as any alcoholic I ever knew. I drank a lot of alcoholics under the table. I could always, almost always the last one up. And drinking is it, but in some strange way I could not describe then, is that I knew I wasn't an alcoholic because I was almost like a mirror image of an alcoholic, like a 180 degrees different. Unlike alcoholics, it is when I get sober and try to be good, that's when my emotions get painful. And that's when my life gets so painful I can't stand it. And that's the longer I try to be good and the harder I clench my fists, it finally gets so bad that I just can't stand it. Unless I do something about it, I'll commit suicide. And that's why I have a few drinks. I don't drink because I'm a drinker. I drink because I'm a feeler. I drink to feel the way alcoholics feel when they get sober. To feel like I'm something. To feel like that I'm not just some dirty old thing that's ashamed of himself all the time. That always goes around this feeling of there's something missing in me and I don't even know what it is, but I better disguise it from people. Something Pat was saying this morning, I so identify with it, talk about it once in a while. This idea of my whole life being a series of shifting roles, always a shifting role. Always, without even being aware of it, just always knowing that if they see me, they won't like it. So give them what you want. Give them what they need. What does this girl want? What does this employer want? What does this guy in the bar want to talk about? What is on and on? Just a series of chameleon, but total chameleon. And never having any understanding at all that I'm doing it. All I know is I'm not enough of myself. And always living in kind of fear, because from time to time people find out that you're phony and humiliate you. And it's just dreadful. And always that underlying feeling that I've had much of my life. Damn it, I'm too sensitive. People have too much power over me. Because no matter how good I feel, one thing I cannot stand is rejection. I cannot stand rejection for people to turn their back on me and to well, once you're cute, you just stay cute, I guess. But the terrible feeling of people always having the ability to ruin my day by hurting my feelings. I look back over my life, I spent most of my life, maybe some of you have too, with hurt feelings, always hurt feelings. You learn not to show it. No, he didn't bother me. But you have another name on your list of dirty bastards you're going to kill someday. I wish they'd had microfilm in those days. I could have kept them all, boy. And that's how I stood outside of this mission. It was cold rain falling. And if I would have had the perception, that's what I would have said if somebody had asked me that question. But nobody talked to me. And I thought to myself, I'm sick, I'm going to die. It's a funny thing about that. Dying, suicidals oftentimes want to die, I guess, but they hardly ever want to be put to death. I don't want to die for reasons beyond my control. I don't want to freeze on the corner. If I die, I'll do it myself, thank you. And I was afraid I was dying. So I walked 71 blocks out to this AA club that asked me to leave a week or two before. And I hated to go out there because I'd really said some terrible things. I was drunk and accused them of corruption and all sorts of things I didn't know I was talking about. And they weren't really glad to see me either. And I came in and slunk in, and One of the reasons I hate about that, because I know enough about it. I've been in and out of AA for years, and I know I'm a good judge of AA in a lot of cities. And this club was not only full of AAs, but it was full of AA fanatics. There's nothing that's more hurtful to an intelligent slipper than AA fanatics. Intelligent non-alcoholics, if you will. What a fanatic, one of the reasons how you can spot them. Now, I'm not a mooch, never been a mooch. But sometimes when you're really, your back's up against the wall, you have to let people know what you need so they know how to help you. And I might say, well, you know, I have no place to stay. And I have no money for food. I don't mind, really, it's all right. My clothes are kind of wet and raggedy, but that's all right. I'll be all right. I've lost everything I've had, and I have no place to go. You know what AA fanatics say? Say, go to a lot of meetings, work the steps, it'll all work out. And of course the answer to that is, oh gee, sir, you're number one with me. And I just hated it. I hated that place. I hung around there, and somebody bought me a hamburger, I guess, and I hung around there for a couple of days, and I had no place to stay. Somebody pointed out to me an old abandoned car in the parking lot, that an old Mercury somebody left years before or something. I just went sitting there, and I slept in that car. I hung around that car. Jesus. You know, I really, a couple times in that car, late at night, cold and hungry. Cold. People sometimes wonder, Dick, or Taper, when I had to train them some years ago when I came to Omaha to talk, that I stayed at his house, I said, you know, I don't care what you do in your house. I don't care what you and your wife do. But by my bedside, there must be cheese and crackers and a Coke when I go to bed. And to this day, I must have cheese or something. And the reason is, so many nights I went to sleep hungry in that damn car that I thought, why are you getting something? You know, by the time I got a little room, I ate every night, and now I can't go to sleep without it. Which is one of the reasons I'm so fat. But anyway, I lay in that car, and I remember thinking, this sounds funny, but it isn't funny at all. I remember thinking, maybe that suicide in Texas was successful after all. Maybe this is what hell is. Just one day of feeling bad after another day feeling bad and nothing to do about it. But I hung around that club, but I don't suppose anybody who ever slipped as long as I have, who's ever stayed sober as long as I have now, 37 some years, wouldn't look back and think, what was different this time? What was different? What changed this time? What made the difference? Why did I, you know, I'd like to know that, not only for my own information, abstract information, but because I would like to be able to convey that to people that I know that are slipping and slipping and are going to die from it. And I'd like to have the information to give them. You know, because I was such a long-term slipper, some of you know, they send me people from around the country. I got a guy now from Wisconsin, a guy from Texas, who are just, everybody's giving up on it. There I am. They said you'd help me. Well, they lied to you. Ooh, you know. I don't say that, but I think it. But I'd like to be able, you know, I'd like to have something to give them. And so would we all. We all know slippers. And you, how can you help them? What is the... And I've come to the reluctant conclusion, at least for me and the people I have known. First of all, there is no magic sentence. There's no piece of information. Apparently there is for some people. Because I've heard speakers say, I'm just having a terrible time. And one day, a man said to me... And it became, oh yeah. I wish I knew that sentence. You know, I wish I have some sick boob. Okay. Listen to this, pal. Never mind if the horse is blind, keep loading the wagon. Yeah! Yeah! That's it! You know. Having trouble, miss? Remember this, wet birds don't fly at night. But for people like me and me, there is no sentence. You get momentary. I've always been, since I've been sober, I've been kind of a very cynical about breakthroughs. I don't like to see breakthroughs, because people who have major breakthroughs are always seem to wind up depressed later. I suppose the best reason for it is because they had a breakthrough thing. Now they're somewhere, so they stopped doing the things that brought around the breakthrough. I don't know why, but anyway, there's no sense. But I wish I knew. I wish there was some way to convey sobriety to people who need it. And I think about that. Probably the best example I've been able to think of for a long time is a few years ago, my grandsons, John and Joe, were in our backyard. I was teaching them to ride a bicycle. And put them on the bike, and they'd fall down. And Joe got a bloody nose and cried, and John scraped his arm. It was just terrible. And I would have given anything to fall down for them, to take the fall, to let me get hurt, let me bleed my nose. But they're just little kids, they know what the hell's doing. And I'm, but you know, you can't do that. You put them back on the bike and say, now move your legs and steer. I don't want to do this anymore, Grandpa. Yes, you do. You just don't know it. And bang. At the end of the night, boy, they were bleeding and sick and they couldn't ride a bike. And I felt like so terrible. Just, oh, man. But we did it again later. And as they tried to do this, one day something happened. I'm sure it's happened to almost everyone in this room. And there's not a person in the world who can describe it or explain how it happens or why it happens. But all of a sudden, you suddenly, out of nowhere, get a sense of balance. And you can now ride a bicycle. And you'll be able to ride a bicycle as long as you live. You can ride a motorcycle. You can ride almost anything with two wheels. But you cannot convey that ability to someone for whom you would give your life. And in a much more complex way, that's the way it is with sobriety. You can be sober and dedicated and full of dedication and zeal. And someone that you would give your life for, you can't make them sober. You cannot give them that gift. We've all had people like that. If you sponsor people very long, you find people like that. The people, some of the people that I went to college with, I would give anything to help that guy, and he could never stay sober. He did one thing for me, though. When I was about three years maybe. I was working in a little advertising, it was a medical corporation. And he called me one night again. He said, Clancy, you've got to come over. I'm drunk. I'm so drunk. I'm so sick. And that time I was full of zeal. And old timers wouldn't go to call on guys who'd been slipping 10 times. I said, well, they're jerks, old jerks. And I remember getting up in the middle of the night and driving from Pasadena all the way to Hollywood and sitting up with them saying, Dick, it's going to be all right. We're going to get through this. Oh, God, Clancy, I just love you. Thank you very much. I drove back about 6:30 in the morning. I was just exhausted, but I didn't care because I'd done something decent. And I took a shower and went to work. I was about half zonked, but I had a great feeling. About 9:30, the phone rang. It was Dick. He said, Clancy? I said, yes, Dick. He said, I thought you said you were coming over. I no longer call on long-term drunken slippers. I tell them how to get to my house. If they can make it, we'll do good. But that doesn't help as a rule. But anyway, what was different this time? What made it different this time? And the best I can think of is something that most people talk about, I guess, sooner or later. The worst feeling I've ever had in my life, I think of all the single feelings, that's the most hopeless and desperate. I suppose that's the feeling I had in that garage in El Paso, Texas, I would imagine, if I could put it together. Feeling of total desperation. Desperation. No matter what you got a reverse Midas effect in your life. Every piece of gold you touch turns to crap. Just boom, boom. Children, home, job. Sooner or later, you just... And it's just desperate. Desperate almost enough to die from it. Now, why would desperation be such a help? I'll tell you why. Because desperation is about the only thing, and extreme pain is the only thing that would ever get me to do things that I didn't want to do. just like in that nut house, the total desperation and shock treatments got me playing their sick little AA game. And like when I was 15 years old on a ship early in the Second World War, total desperation and fear got me to do things that were, including taking my first drink of alcohol, that I never would have done otherwise, I felt. But desperation. And this desperation consists of doing things to a little by little fit in. I don't want to fit in with these people necessarily, but as was said earlier at this podium, that's why you stay with, that's why they say stick with winners. Because chameleons like me eventually become the color that your background is. You run with losers, you become a loser. If you run with winners enough, hopefully you'll become a winner. At least you'll be doing the things, not because you want to do them, but to get their approval without even being aware of it. Not even outspoken approval, but just acceptance. And I started doing dumb little things. I hated it. One of the things that hurt me the worst, they said, get a sponsor. You know, everybody has a sponsor. Oh, man, I had sponsors. I'll tell you what sponsors were to me. Sponsors are people that you get them, try to get a big name, and don't get too close to them because they always have goofy ideas, but if you get drunk, call them. Hello, Bob. I'm afraid I've let you and AA down. I drank. And if you've got a real sponsor, you say, no, you haven't let us down. You're sick. You've had a relapse. That's all. I'm coming right over. I'll get a couple of the guys. We'll bring a pint and get you off this. It'll be all right. You need some money. Now, that's what sponsors are. And I saw this guy. I'd seen him in the movies playing loving roles, uncles and kindly roles. And he'll be my sponsor. I said, Bob, I'm kind of new. Would you be my sponsor? He said, yeah. And I'll tell you, over the next few weeks I discovered he should have won the Academy Award for every loving role he ever played, because he was a cruel, nasty, right-wing fascist AA pig. He just was terrible. I mean, he'd say things to me like, kid, call me anytime you want, a day or a night. If it's at night, it better be important. But you call me anytime you want, up till the time you take a drink. Once you take a drink, save your nickel, kid, because all you're going to hear from me is a click and a dial tone. This guy doesn't know much about AA. And I tell him how I felt. He said, I don't care how you feel, just do what I tell you. And I try to stay away from him. But little by little, he intimidated me. I felt so bad. And he said, oh, Bob's nice guy. Hey, Bob is... But you know, he got me to... Now, I'll tell you what desperation does. Desperation gets you to do things that you would not ordinarily do. For instance, Bob might say to me, hey, don't apologize to that woman. Why should I? Because you called her a bitch. Try never to get a sponsor that's got snitches everywhere, because they just, it's a sick little habit. I said, well, Bob, she happens to be a bitch. Why do you think so? She told her newcomer not to go to bed with me. Well, she was absolutely right. You'd apologize. Now, I'll tell you, if I was feeling good, I'd say, you go screw yourself, Bob. How do you like that? But when you're intimidated, you find yourself saying, you bitch. Now, I got you that job and you've been there one day. Go to work tomorrow morning. Jesus, Bob. They're treating me like crap. You know, I used to be a big executive. I'm a talented writer, if I can get a chance. They got me wrapping packages for $1.49 an hour. They treat me like an idiot, Bob. It's just, I don't care. It's the only job you can get. Go to work. Now, anybody would say, go to hell. But if you're desperate, you might say, I want you to go to that Tuesday night meeting, that Central Hollywood meeting on La Brea. Oh, Jesus, Bob. They're just a bunch of weirdos. Some of the men dressed like women. Some of the women dress like men. One guy dressed like an Arab with pointy-toed shoes. Bela Lugosi goes to that meeting. For Christ's sake, if you fall asleep, you'll bite your neck. You know. That's a weirdo meeting. And he explained to me, you'll fit right in. Go to the goddamn meeting. And you and I told him, I said, and this went on and on, and after a while it got me even doing terrible things. And little by little I began to take the actions of Alcoholics Anonymous without being aware of it, just to keep that old puke off my back and to get along with the people around me. I didn't want things that couldn't help me. I look back now, and that's when my life changed. I already knew all about AA. I knew all the spiritual prayers. I knew everything about it. I knew the third step prayer and the seventh step prayer, and I knew all about Bill Wilson. I knew everything. Dr. Bob, I had sponsors who were giants, seemed to me. And it was when I began to do the things rather than talk about them and know them that my life changed. And it didn't get better. It just got enough better so I didn't drink. You know. And I stayed sober. I got so wrapped up in there were people in AA that some I liked me for no apparent reason. And I, some of the guys, I'll tell you a guy, he's dead now, so I mention his name, who's so kind to me, a guy named Jack Bailey. He was queen for a day. He had this television program for years. And he was one of the great AAs of all time. He'd come by and say, you know, Ken, I understand that you used to be in advertising. You ever seen my show? Yeah, I thought. You got any ideas about it? I said, no. Pretty good, I thought. He says, thanks for the advice. Here's $10. And away it'd go. Glad I was able to help you, Jack. I was doing dumb and being kind and patting you on the back. Great inspiration to me. Great inspiration. Later on, my sponsor, Chuck Chamberlain, who'd been with my sponsor for 20-some years, died. And all I could think of to say to his eulogy was that one of the great things he had done, he always talked to people who weren't worthy of talking to. People I would pass up. Oh, Chuck, don't go around him. He's a loser. He's a phony. Don't talk to him. God's kid. God's kid. Some people have that facility. I can do it, but I have to work at it. I have to make myself do it. But I'm always glad I did it when I did it, but I prefer not to. I'd rather be with pretty people and cute people and talented people. And it's really distressing when you have to... Did you see the movie... I'm sure most of you did. My name is Bill W. One of the greatest instructional piece of that movie was at the last scene when he's at this little meeting in San Bernardino. And it was kind of a dumb meeting. And he wanted to say, hey, I'm Bill Wilson. I started this. And he looked at his wife and she went, so he found the least likely guy there and sat down and said, how are you, pal? Having trouble with your drinking? And that's how the movie ended. And what a great message that is. But people like me forget it because I'm very too human. But I try to do it. But anyway, he got me taking actions. Little by little, I stayed. So the irony of Alcoholics Anonymous is that the very same pain that insists that people like you and me must drink to stand it. Well, put it this way. I do a lot of flying. Obviously, flying in again to Jacksonville the other night from Chicago, and raining, and the plane is bumping around, and they're coming in pretty fast, and they hit the ground, and it's slippery, and you figure, I hope this baby's got good brakes, because we're going to go right down into the ocean. But you know, you don't need brakes. They don't even hardly use brakes on these planes. They reverse the thrust of the jets. The same jets that are pushing you this way are now pushing you this way to stop you. And in much the same manner, in a very ironical way, the very same pain and desperation that insists that people like me must drink to stand it, if I allow that to be redirected, can be used to get me to take actions I would never take under any other duress except that pain and desperation. At least for intense people like me. You know, I look over the years, I look back now, there's always somebody... It's got some better way than AA. 2 years ago, there was this rational recovery. Got a lot of press. No God, just we're real sober. And now there's last couple months ago, there's an article about people who can return to social drinking. And made the front pages. There's always been things like that. And I think, now, I don't really want to, and I wouldn't do it, but I think, what is it? How can they do it? How can they go without anything? And I find it, in this book, there's something said in there a number of times that you don't pay much attention to, but it suddenly strikes you, because my life depends on remembering it. Bill Wilson continually refers to alcoholics of our type. I'm sure there are other types, but my type finds that sobriety is unbearable. But I stayed around. So I finally took a fourth step. One day I was going to commit suicide. Now 6 days over, he just got fired as a dishwasher. And I got fired. I was going to commit suicide. And I called up my sponsor to see if he'd feel sorry. And I didn't bother. It started really early. In my judgment, AA doesn't help people like me. What am I going to do? He said, why don't you write your fourth step? And I just explained to him the week before, I've taken my fourth step with a psychiatrist. It doesn't help to do it with an out-of-work actor. You know, what's that? You know. He used to get testy. And I said, Jesus, Bob, in my judgment, AA is not enough for me. There's something deeply sick within me. I've lost everything. There's no to continue. In my judgment, and he explained to me, he said, in your judgment, who cares about your judgment? You live in the back seat of an abandoned car, for Christ's sake. If I wanted your judgment, I'd put my head in the back window and ask you for it. I'm living in a big house in Pacific Palisades. Who cares what you think? Now write your damn inventory. I wrote an inventory. I put in stuff in there I never told a psychiatrist. It's just, oh. People later said, why wouldn't you tell your psychiatrist these things? They're very simple. When you're paying that kind of dough, you can't afford rejection. Get out of my office, you sick prevert. But you can put it in the inventory. And a week or two later, I took it in. I read it. He drove me along the ocean. And he gave me a flashlight, and I read it to him. You know, I thought he was going to make me get out of his car, but got up my oxygen, he was yawning. Getting near the end of it there, boy. I thought I made him sick. But I've taken that trip maybe 250 times since then, on the driver's side, with some other goof over there with a flashlight. And don't tell me you ever perk up your ears even is when they say something like, I want to explain this part before I read it. Because it's always the same. There's only so many minds and bodies can do. And we all come here needing conversion desperately. It's an amazing thing how similar we all are. That's what's the most amazing thing I've learned in all my years, how similar we all are. That's why such a simple program can work for such a diversified group. I was thinking this morning, and then parenthesis, I'm almost done with my talk. By the 1930s, Dr. Marley, I'm sure remember that, because he's a literate graduate of Columbia University, Pulitzer Prize-winning book called The Bridge of San Luis Rey. Remember that, Hal? And what it was is about a bridge that had collapsed, and a number of people on it were killed. What this book went back and traced them each, their labyrinthian route, how they all happened to be on the bridge that day in that obscure little town. And I was thinking to myself, that's almost the way it is in AA. You look at the speakers we have this week. What kind of labyrinthian route did we all take to wind up in Jekyll Island, Georgia, early in March? Jesus, a series of crossroads, we just happened to take the right way. And as Norm Alp used to say, my life has been seconds and inches. Too much this way and I'd have been gone. And there never was a truer line written in that book than we are people who would not ordinarily associate. And it's just amazing. I wouldn't have probably known anyone in this room. I wouldn't have known people whom I sponsor in this room for years. People I love would almost give my life for. And yet here we are together and we take it for granted, as has been said so many times. But little by little I stayed sober. And the last thing I want to pretty much say, I want to give, all this has been an introduction, I want to just give a 5-minute little pep talk to these two few boob newcomers. Let me say this, I eventually became very successful and I'm doing very well now, and I know that you're happy for me. I've got it all together and you haven't. Usually you just think that, but you might as well say it tonight if you won't remember it. But I stayed sober until something happened, little by little. It didn't happen fast. I never had any breakthroughs to speak of. All was slow, evolutionary, Menshevik, never Bolshevik. And it boils down to this. Eventually, I discovered what was wrong with me. And out of bet my life, I never would have found out. Tonight I said, my name is Clancy Imslet and I'm an alcoholic. And nobody paid any attention to that. Sure you are. But when did I become an alcoholic? I wasn't an alcoholic when I drank. I wasn't an alcoholic the day I got sober. I haven't become an alcoholic since. When did I become an alcoholic? I became an alcoholic when I stayed here long enough and did enough things, mechanical things at first, mechanical, and did things. That's what they talk about, surrender. You surrender your will. You don't surrender your car or your house. You surrender your perception of what is right for you. That is the hardest surrender you will ever make in your life. Because no matter what anybody says, I know they mean well, but this, I've got time for theory. I got to do what I know is to be right. And that may kill you. So you take the action. I took the action to survive long enough to discover one thing. The one thing I always knew, I cannot really be an alcoholic, because my number one problem is not really alcohol. I drink, and I get drunker than anybody. But it is not my number one problem, and nobody understands that. And here I discovered that that is one of the few beliefs I had that was absolutely true. What saved my life is that when I discovered in Alcoholics Anonymous, my problem is not alcohol. In fact, if my problem is alcohol, I shouldn't even be here, nor should you. Now, doesn't that sound upside down, like somebody's inner child running amok through the streets? You know? Of course, you say that. Of course, the problem is alcohol. I'm convinced the message of this book, the message of the things we do here, I'm sure I'm one of the very few people in this room who sat and talked to Bill Wilson for about an hour in 1963 when I was sober about 5 years. And Chuck Chamberlain and the great giants I've ever known eventually convinced me. My problem is, but of course it's alcohol. I can disprove that in 10 seconds. If alcohol is the problem, detoxes turn out recovered people. And they don't. Hospitals turn out recovered people. Treatment centers turn out recovered people. Jails turn out recovered people. Toilets turn out recovered people. Still, the classic American detox is the toilet. You can have all the hospitals and chains and hospitals. But most of us know the feeling of kneeling in front of a porcelain altar of a morning and saying your most sincere prayer. Oh, God. Some mornings when you're sick enough, your body will reject alcohol from both ends at once, which is really exciting. Not only are you terribly sick, but you're called upon to make a series of split-second decisions. And every answer must be right. But if getting sober was the answer, that's how you get sober. The problem is not alcohol. Then what is it? And if you're new, you may wonder, is this like one of those places where we have to keep buying new literature and buying new videos and buying new things and new insights? Not at all. You already know what's wrong with you, but you don't know you know it. The problem here is something you've heard discussed many times this weekend, everywhere you go. Something called alcoholism. You say, well, alcoholism, you said alcohol wasn't a problem. That's right. They sound alike, but they're significantly different. They sound alike. I could talk for 2 hours on the differences there, we're a little late. Let's put in one sentence. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and straightening up your act. you'll discover in this strange phenomenon called alcoholism, this mind-boggling, bodily destroying, confidence wrecking, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you'll discover sooner or later, if you haven't discovered yet, that stopping drinking and cleaning up your act has no significant long-term effect on your life other than to gradually make it so painful you cannot stand it. Even our book recognizes that, talks about it. There are points which there is no adequate defense against the first drink. Well, if the problem is not alcohol and it's alcoholism, so that, put it this way, sobriety is what makes alcoholism a fatal disease. If it weren't for that, we'd all be home free. But in alcoholism, you stay sober long enough and eventually the pain is so intense it blots out the pain that accompanied the relief from drinking. The curse of the alcoholic is that no matter how well he wants to stay sober, sooner or later, he must drink or sedate again or go mad or die. And one, that does, but even that doesn't make you an alcoholic, it turns out. One other thing must be present. And I want to talk to you a little, just a minute about this, because you may not even realize what an unusual thing this is. You must be one of the 6 or 7% of people in the world who get an unnatural reaction to drinking and never have any idea it's an unnatural reaction, because you have nothing to compare it against. When you get a reaction inside of you, you have nothing to compare it against. Just like when I eat strawberries. I don't know how strawberries taste to you. I assume they taste the same as they do to me. When I drink alcohol, I get an unnatural reaction. So what is this unnatural reaction? Well, you hear speakers say things like, I stayed drunk around the clock 25 years. Now, that's an alcoholic. That is an alcoholic. No human body can stay drunk 25 years, 25 months, 25 weeks, 25 days. Can't stay drunk 14 straight days in the laboratory. One of the rottenest parts about drinking is you keep sobering up again. You may not stay sober, but you sober up again and again and again. What is this unnatural reaction? Makes you act crazy? You hear some of these speakers say, and then I escaped from Leavenworth, raped 9 nuns, knocked over a mental health clinic, and then I started acting badly. You know, boy, there's the alcohol. That's a flamboyant thing. But that doesn't mean you're an alcoholic. A lot of guys in prisons are not alcoholics. You're in jails or in mental hospitals. There's a lot of people in those places who aren't alcoholics. There are a lot of alcoholics who aren't in those places. So what is it? It's such a simple thing that if you were like me, it would take you 10,000 years to identify this as an unnatural reaction unless you listen to it here. You know what the unnatural reaction is? It must have the unnatural ability to almost instantly make everything all right. That's all. Just make everything all right. It must, put it a little technically, it must alter my perception of reality. It must change my relationship to my perceived environment. But you and I know what to mean. It fills holes that nothing else ever does. I'll tell you, it adds technicolor. It's like Dorothy going to Oz. Just, I watched Oz with my grandchildren at Christmas sometimes. Watched The Wizard of Oz. It used to be all the time, Christmas. And I've never seen it yet. But when it gets to the end, I can't do it, but I want to shout, don't go back to Kansas, for Christ's sake. It's all gray back there. There's color here. There may be wicked witches. What the hell? You get used to them. I did. Come on. Let's go, baby. And there's nothing wrong with it. You're allowed to talk. I want to say one more thing about this convention. I don't know when I've heard a convention in 10 years where every participant was an out and out stinking drunkard. It is such a blessing. I'm an alcoholic and an addict and I twist baby chickens' necks and I... And who gives a shit what you do? You may take drugs, you may have done other things, but we are here as alcoholics. I don't judge. I just, for those of you, I'll take 1 minute before I stop to tell you why that is. But anyway, this thing called alcoholism, you hear a lot of people talk about addiction as though it's something really romantic and wonderful. I'm not an addict, but I've been working with addicts for over 25 years, and I know as much about addiction as most addicts, I would assume. I know what heroin does. I know the wonderful euphoria you get in heroin. But what happens in heroin, pretty soon you can't get there anymore. So you overdose. What kills heroin addicts? Always overdosing, trying to get back to that spot they can't get to. And later on, you have to have people with you all the time because you just keep shooting. Cocaine gets away after omnipotence, just wonderful omnipotence, just grand. But it's a speed drug, so the side effects eventually kick in. Growing paranoia and restlessness and discontent and terrible addiction. Finally, it's a funny thing. 10 years ago, there were still medical journals writing articles proving that cocaine cannot be addictive while people were dying right and left from the addiction. And eventually your body starts to go little by little. But alcoholics, this doesn't happen. For people like you and me, at least for quite a while, when you start to drink, you just stay right where you are, but you become a different person. I'm not afraid. Sometimes I fight cops. I reject instead of being rejected. I do a lot of things. And it's a wonderful thing. And what's wrong with that? You'll never find a better thing. I'll tell you, being an alcoholic is the best thing that ever happened to me. Alcohol is the best friend I've ever had. Sounds terrible to say that in an AA meeting, but I'll tell you it's true. Friends come and go. Love comes and goes. Cities come and go. But a few drinks, boy, it just makes it all right. There's only one little drawback. There's always a price tag. It's a stinking world out there, I'll tell you. There's always a price tag. And the price tag for that is that sooner or later, you little by little become dependent on it. Because there's a school of thought, and I believe it to be correct, that if alcohol really works for you, there's an argument that can be made, your true emotional growth slows down and even stops at that time. Because you no longer have to wrestle with emotional conflict and deal with things. You can drink and defer it and pay the consequences later. So many of us feel when we get sober, look back, that we're grown-up bodies, grown-up brains, grown-up abilities, grown-up incomes, grown a lot of things, at the beck and call of intermittent childish emotions. What we call alcoholic emotions, or another way you can put them, childish emotions. And that's a very difficult thing. But you, it doesn't happen, you become dependent on alcohol. Eventually alcohol gets to be a problem. So you stop. And all our speakers this weekend have talked about that I stopped. But eventually they started again. They didn't know why. But we all know why, because now we know why, because you can't make it sober. So you drink, but you can't keep drinking, so you got to get sober. And you can't stay sober, so pretty soon you got to drink. And people are giving you pressure, and the heat is on, and you try to control it. In chapter 3, that funny little paragraph that people laugh at, things we've tried, changing from scotch to brandy, drinking beer only, drinking always at home, never drinking at home, taking swearing off with or without a solemn oath, reading spiritual literature, taking physical exercise, all the things. Why do people do such stupid things? We've all been there, I believe, if you're an alcoholic, because you got to a position now where drinking is getting to be a problem, but you can't bear to stay sober. So you got to find a combination in there that can make it. And doing, obsessed with the idea that I will find a way to control and enjoy my drinking, and never knowing that for me that's past. That doorway is closed a long time ago. I may control it for a while, but I'll never enjoy it. Or I may enjoy it, but I can't control it. I can't control and enjoy it. And that's the curse of alcoholism. And people like you and me, I'll tell you how remarkably pervasive this is. In America today, where there's more sobriety than any place in the history of the world, there's AA everywhere. My home group in Los Angeles, Bob says, 1,200 every Wednesday night. Just nothing but successful people, most of them, except the newcomers. In America, it is estimated around 95% of alcoholics still die drunk, or it's a direct result of drinking. And I'll guarantee you, because my job today, I see alcoholics die. And they all die same, in one form or another, the same thing. But I'm not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. One form or another, the same thing. But I'm not really an alcoholic. You don't understand. My problems really came. My pain comes when I'm sober. These are real problems. I just drank to get some relief. I get a lot of hand, and a lot of people think drinking's my problem. But it isn't. It's things I can't even describe. And little do they know, they've just defined the disease of alcoholism. And that's why it's so important to realize that getting here and knowing the words and saying the words and being cute, pretty soon you feel good. You feel, well, that's, I'm better now. You have no idea. If that made you better, there'd be no need for AA. Because I've been sober a long time, and I've been active a long time, I've had the chance to do something the last few years that most of you haven't had a chance to do yet. But I've been asked to speak in exotic places, you know, like Cape Town and Johannesburg and Berlin and Dublin and Belfast and Amsterdam and London and Sydney and Auckland and Tahiti and a lot of places. You'd think you'd find exotic AA in all these places, exotic alcoholics. Except for the accents, you hear the same things you'll hear this weekend or anywhere else at your home group. I'm not sure I'm an alcoholic. And somebody else says, yes, you are. And we come here and we find something that is so unusual. We come to understand that there's a name for this condition. It is called alcoholism. And that's what AA is designed to work with. Now, why is it so necessary to be an alcoholic? For a very simple reason. There's no information here that you haven't gotten before. There isn't anybody in this room that hasn't got enough advice to last them for 5,000 years. We all got advice. And as was said earlier today, people come up and say things like, I know how you feel. And you just have to, you can't say it, but you want to shriek, no, you don't. You don't know how I feel. Nobody knows how I feel. Nobody understands. You stay here and do these things, and you listen to these people, and you simulate interest in what's going on. And eventually some old day, some old fool will come over and say, I know how you feel. And you'll think, why, for Christ's sake, he does know how I feel. And that's the first rope across the abyss. And then maybe another rope. And one day you get a little tenuous catwalk. And one day you get a little road. And one day you have an 8-lane freeway going across there. But it all boils down to identification, of knowing that you know how I feel. For me to believe that you know how I feel is what gets me to do what you say. I have all the nice people in the world try to help me, but some old out-of-work actor who convinced me he knew how I felt got me to do things that I never would have done, and it's made me live a life I never dreamed. A lot of nice things have happened. I eventually got held a job, and I got to be, after a while, active again, and got successful in radio and television in Hollywood, and got some corporations, and when I was 15 years sober in some hideous fit of misjudgment, I left a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 22 years, I run the mission on Skid Row that threw me out in 1958. And people say, well, why would you give up your career to run that lousy mission? And I have to tell them, it was such a significant decrease in salary, I thought it was spiritual. But it's a funny thing. People say, you're such a wonderful man. I'm not a wonderful man at all. Not Monday morning, but the next time I go to work, I'll get on that freeway out by the ocean to drive down Skid Row. I don't want to go there. So my car wants to get off in Beverly Hills. I have to fight it. It wants to go to my office. Beverly Hills were pretty blondes and tight sweaters said, here's your coffee, Mr. Immisland. Anything else? I don't want to go to Skid Row and see who got stabbed to death last night. These poor aliens poured across that border so frightened they carry knives, and now they're stabbing each other for a piece of bread. And who had a convulsion, smashed their head to the sidewalk, and who's dying on the street. I don't want to do that. And yet the funny thing is, as I've said it many times, when I go home at night sometimes, I always feel like more of a man inside of me than I ever did going down all those elevators in Beverly Hills popping my fingers in my shiny suit. Now, if you're kind of new, I want to give you the wrong impression. even if you stay sober, even if you get a sponsor, even if you get action, we can't guarantee you that in 15 years you can have your own mission. You know, there's only so many go around. I got mine, and, you know, that's for you. I can guarantee you that you'll walk with some degree of dignity that you never thought possible. The most greatest help you'll ever have is to believe that you know what is wrong with you. Alcoholics Anonymous, for a cynical, nasty, pseudo-intellectual like me, Alcoholics Anonymous is the only thing in my life that has never eventually disillusioned me. It has always done what it says it would do when I do what I'm supposed to do. And that's why we suggest you stay here. Not to become good. Some people become good. Some people become so good that they have a little beer to celebrate. The last thing I want to say is this. Now, this is going to sound a little strange. I don't know if I ever said this before. But I've been saying this to a newcomer recently. My life has always been, much of my life was, I have two speeds, good and bad. And I stay good as long as I can. And one day go, ah! When you come to A, you think, I'm going to raise my, what you're going to do, you're going to lower your standards. You're going to lower good. You're going to lower perfection down to a little better than you are right now. Instead of the way I've spent my life up here. Oh, I missed it. I'll raise it a little higher. Oh, shit. It's a step-by-step time. The greatest inspiration I ever learned finally came to me. Bill Wilson had a spiritual experience, but most of us have a spiritual awakening. Alcoholics Anonymous, in some way no one can describe, the 12 steps bring about an incremental spiritual experience. So you got to do it little by little. And you do it, and you start to feel better. And there's only one other difficult time. There's only two potentially dangerous times in sobriety. One is when you're feeling bad, and one is when you're feeling good. So you got to keep doing the things both times. Then you walk with a little degree of dignity. I really enjoyed this weekend. I've heard guys I've never heard before. I respect them because we're all in the path together. I hope we all stay here. I hope if somebody has to go, I hope it's them. I'll tell you that. But I don't think they'll have to do it. Stay active. Get involved. Be a part of life. You'll be so glad you did. Thank you.